My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. 2022 is certainly turning out to be a landmark year for Australian distilling. There's the accolades for Starwood Whisky, which in June was named the most awarded distillery of the year at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition. And then came the news that 3 out of 4 nominees for the IWSC International Gin Producer of the Year Award are Australian. And you just heard recently on the podcast from Philip Moore, the first Australian inducted into the Gin Magazine Hall of Fame. It all coincides with the 30th anniversary of Lark Distillery, the whisky company founded by Bill Lark in 1992, which effectively started the modern era of Australian distilling. In this special episode of Drinks Adventures, produced in partnership with Lark, I sat down with Bill for a chat reflecting on the milestone. I learned how John Grant, the fifth generation owner of Scotland's famous Glenfarclas Distillery, helped Bill get started making whisky in the very early days. And I asked Bill his thoughts on Lark as it is today, a very different business to what he had originally envisioned. First up, though, I'm excited to share some highlights from Lark Distillery's 30th anniversary gala event held on May 26, 2022 at Lark's new site in Pontville, Tasmania. It was emceed by Bill's son Jack and attended by 200 guests from across Australia. The celebration started by honouring the Mummery Mina country that the Pontville site resides on with a welcome to country and traditional smoking ceremony.
So no matter where you are in Tasmania, whether it's a football ground, a car park, or the beach, you're on country. So we just want to thank the organisers, Lark Distillery, a big mention to Okerain, AJ King, Priscilla, to those guys for inviting us out to perform for you tonight. So thank you very much.
Folks, can you please welcome Bill Lark, my dad, and Patrick Maguire to the stage. Two of the many founding fathers of the Tasmanian whisky. Come on up, of the Tasmanian whisky industry.
There's one very, very, very important person that's unable to be here tonight, and that's my wife, Lynn.
Yeah.
She's the backbone of what became Lark Distillery. I was just the guy that Lynn pushed out in front of the media because she was too shy to be there. Lynn wasn't just behind everything I did. Lynn was right there at the front and the fore. She was torn that she couldn't be here. But anyway, I want to acknowledge Lynn and say thank you very much to Lynn for all you've done for me and for this industry. I can honestly say my whisky dream started with my father-in-law, who looked for any excuse to get away from mowing the lawns and doing the housework. Fishing was good, but it also meant we could enjoy a whisky together. And my ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky. And where I wanted that to take us, I wasn't sure, and to be honest, I wasn't worried about that. I just thought, first of all, let's just see if Tasmania is capable of making a good whisky. And if we can do that, then who knows? Maybe one day we'll end up with a distillery and a business that provides a product that people like. I cannot believe I'm sitting here 30 years later with so many wonderful people around us celebrating an industry.
When we first started doing all these things, just to find a cooper, was nearly impossible. They came and went. How do you order bottles, distribution, just getting an education on how do you actually make the stuff. We taught ourselves, but now all these things are falling into place. Lark are now, they've got this property and they're about to build another fantastic distillery here. And there's other distilleries doing the same. Things have sort of come full circle, but at the same time, things are just about to start, I think.
Good on you, Pat.
Well said.
I didn't know how to make whiskey until I had that phone call from John Grant and I got some encouragement from him and help. I know I needed to start with a beer without hops. I wasn't a brewer, but I knew Cascade made a pretty good beer up the road, and I went to see them, and they stopped a big production run of whatever it was they were brewing at the time and filled up a vat for me to take home and ferment and to start distilling. Just everywhere I went, I just had the most amazing help. And from that, I've learned, never be afraid to tell people what it is you want to do in life. I know a lot of people are afraid that if they have a good idea, somebody might steal it. But my experience is, in Australia and in Tasmania in particular, people just want to help you. If you let people know what it is you're going to do, you'll get much more help than anything else. And in fact, people used to say to me, "So Bill..." Oh, one of the other things I discovered at the customs office was we were acting under the Distillation Act of 1901, which was fairly restrictive when it came to small stills. And I said to them, "Well, look, I've only got a tiny wee little still. Is there anything like an experimental license or something?" And they said, "No, Bill, unless you actually build a big distillery, you can't get a license." And I just found that that was probably going to be the end of it. But I remember walking past our local federal member's office, went in and saw Duncan Kerr, introduced myself to him, and he said, "Bill, we've got to do something about this." He got on the phone straight away to Barry Jones. You've probably all heard this story before. But within no time at all, Barry Jones changed the Distillation Act, the regulations to the Act, to allow small stills. The point of that story is, if I hadn't have been game to ask that question, it might not have happened.
Bill and myself went off to various places around the world trying to sell our wares. One time we ended up in Paris, of all places. And we get there and we set up our little stand in the corner of this giant room, and there's people from all over the world there. All the Scottish distilleries represented there. It was quite a thing to see. And there's Bill and myself flying our little Aussie flag, few bottles of our whiskies there, and people were taking a big arc around us. They saw the Aussie flag and thought, "Oh, we don't want to look at this." So they'd go past us, and we were sort of thinking, "What are we going to do? How are we going to get people interested in our whisky?" So after a little while, we summoned up the courage to go out into the crowd and start talking to people and bring them back to our table, and which they reluctantly did. And eventually we managed to get people to try our whiskies. And they'd sort of reluctantly lift the glass up to their nose and have a little sniff and, "Oh." And then they'd have a little taste and they'd just say, "Oh, this is whiskey." I think that particular show went on for 4 days or something. And after a little while, after a day or so, we eventually had people coming straight to us first thing in the morning or as soon as the doors opened, and saying, "Oh, look, you know, we were here the other day and we walked past you, but we've been told to come and try this whiskey, so here we are." That really gave us a lot of encouragement.
I remember when I first released my whiskey, and I think Pat was working with us out at Richmond at the time, and I was scared stiff of, we done the right thing, and we made something that people might want to buy, and we only had a few bottles, and a Scottish bloke walked in the door, and he said, "What is it you're doing in here? You're not be making whiskey, would you?" And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, sir, I am." And he said, "Well, you better give me a taste." And I said to him, "I'm sorry, sir, I can't give you a taste. I've only got a small amount. I can sell you a taste for $3. Well, did he go crook? $3. Anyway, he reluctantly handed over his $3. He took a sip and went straight to the door. And I thought, uh-oh, he's going to spit it out. Instead, he yelled out, "Hey, Mary, come in here. They're making malt whiskey, and it's not bad." And he bought 3 bottles.
Mm.
For all those I don't know or don't know yet, I'm Cam Brett, the president of the Tasmania Whiskey and Spirits Association, and my beautiful wife Susie's here. One of the most exciting things I feel tonight, I've almost got a bit of a tear in my eye, is for me, this is almost like being in Scotland in 1845. You know, we're 30 years in of a licensed industry. There are distilleries popping up, new distilleries. They've got exciting stories. I know, you know, Callanton Mill, of course, John's here tonight. You know, they're developing a world-class distillery in Oatlands that will revitalise that town. You know, it's a really exciting time for our industry. So make sure you tell your grandkids that you were here for the 30th anniversary of our industry, because this is pretty special. So my question is, it's about the future. What do you see as the most important thing that our industry undertakes in the next 30 years?
Cam, I actually think we're in for some really exciting time in our... it's been exciting for 30 years, but we're about to enter a pretty significant phase. Nearly all of us have started off as craft distilleries, small craft distilleries on a kitchen table, and have grown. The wonderful thing is, from that, and despite the small scale of it, we've been able to make a big impact in the world whisky industry and market. And Tasmanian whisky is really high in demand. And fortunately, because of that, we've seen the ability of some of these distilleries to grow into big enough distilleries to be able to really put Tasmania on the map in a way as small distilleries we haven't been able to. We've been able to see people come into Tasmania aware of the reputation we have to contribute to that. So I think we've got such a wonderful future ahead of us where our brand is really well known around the world, and we'll be able soon to be able to meet that demand and present our whiskies to the world market. That's going to open the doors and benefit both the very smallest distillery and the very biggest distillery here in Tasmania. And I see a really exciting future for us. I guess the challenge for us is to all stay really good mates and just appreciate the fact that there's some exciting times ahead for us, and to work together still into the future. I'd like to raise a glass to the next 30 years and to all of you here tonight. Thank you very much. Here's to the next 30 years.
Cheers.
Well, Bill Lark, thanks so much for joining me for this long overdue interview on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, James. Great to talk to you.
Now, we're speaking, you know, as Lark celebrates its 30th anniversary. How does it feel for you to be seeing, you know, where the industry's at today and also where the business that you and Lynn founded is at today?
Yeah, look, it's quite amazing to be sitting here surrounded by something like 80-odd distilleries in Tasmania and nearly 400 throughout Australia after just 30 years. I mean, I can't believe where those 30 years have gone, but 30 years ago it was Lynn and I on our kitchen table all on our own, and we've got this wonderful industry around us with some great people.
My numbers are badly out of date. I thought it was 50 in Tasmania, so it's shot up just in the last 12 months or so.
Yeah, look, it's changing probably almost daily. And the good news is there's been a boom in things like the gins being made around Australia, and what surprises me is everybody's telling me they're finding a market for it. It's a wonderful thing.
I wasn't aware of the history of Lark and Glenfarclas, so maybe you can go back and just tell us how you developed the relationship with John Grant.
When Lynn and I decided we'd like to see if we could make whisky in Tasmania, we were lucky enough to pick up a beautiful little copper pot still at an auction. And by the time we got a license, we sort of sat at home stunned thinking, what do we do now? We still don't know how to make whisky. While we were sort of worrying about that, within 2 weeks of getting our license, I had a phone call at 10 o'clock at night. I picked the phone up and hello, and it was, hello, it's John Grant here from the Glenfarclas Distillery. And I'm going like, gosh, John, how can I help you? And he goes, no, Bill, please. My distributor in Hobart tells me you've got a license to make whisky. Would you allow me to help you make good whisky? And I said, John, you've got no idea how pleased I am you phoned tonight, because I'm sitting here wondering what the heck I'm doing. I mean, we stayed on the phone for probably an hour and a half that night talking about what we were going to do and how we could help. And so by the time we'd been around for a little while and people started saying they'd like to start a distillery, could I help them? those words of John Grant were ringing in my ear, and if he was good enough to help me, I felt obliged that it would be a good thing to help other people as well.
Was Glenfarclas a distillery that was already on your radar back then?
Yeah, what was quite spooky about getting a phone call from John Grant was that the night that Lynn and I decided we were going to apply for a licence, we tasted that idea with a 15-year-old Glenfarclas, and we said to ourselves, wouldn't it be amazing if one day into the future we could make a whiskey like this? And then blow me down, who should phone but John Grant?
So how did the relationship evolve from there, and, you know, how much were you calling on John for advice?
Oh, quite a bit in the early days. You know, we'd start distilling and he'd sort of given us some ideas, and I'd be ringing up saying, what do I do now? What's this noise? What's happening? And he was terrific. And some years after we got started, he said, look, Bill, I'd like to come and visit you. So he came to Tasmania and he ran a masterclass for 30 of my friends out at our distillery, which was just terrific. And we've been across and visited on many occasions and, you know, kept in touch, and it's been a wonderful relationship. And it's been the reason why I've sort of tried to encourage this sense of collegiality and collaboration in the Australian industry.
Yeah, and it is amazing, you know, the number of different distillers that I speak to, and when I'm asking them to sort of tell me their origin story, the number of times your name comes up. One example was when I was down at Joe Adger in New South Wales. You know, I had Valero on the podcast a couple of years ago, and he talked about, you know, the role that you'd counselled him a little bit with his distillery plans.
Yeah, look, and the great thing about that for me is that I've got to meet and make friends with so many wonderful people. And I really like to think that our industry wouldn't be as strong a brand as it is around the world without all these great people that believe in collegiality, in the sense that if we help each other to make a good spirit, it's going to help us all. And Valero is one of those great people.
And for people who don't know, how would you describe the Glenfarclas, you know, the distillery background, but also the house style, which is obviously all sherry casks, sort of their signature flavour, aren't they?
Absolutely. And Glenfarclas is one of those few remaining family-owned distilleries. John's sort of retiring back out of it now, and his son George is running the distillery. And so we share that background, I suppose, that Lark started off as the Lark family and grown. But Glenfarclas, I remember from back in those days of toasting with the Glenfarclas, I'd always looked up to that as pinnacle of a sherry whiskey, that this is something I'd love to make. And when you nose it on the nose, you just get that really lovely. Do you remember when you were a kid going to the pitches and we used to eat those hard caramel toffees, the Columbine toffees, came in a little blue and red wrapper? I just get that really lovely caramel note on the nose that comes with a good sherry cask. And then at the front of the palate, when you take a sip of this whiskey, it really is creamy and oily, sweet, and then it just builds slowly across the palate and stays on the middle of the palate heading towards the finish. And again, it's sort of luscious and chewy and just as toffee and lovely, delicate floral notes that sort of come through the palate, finishing just very long and warm. It's a classic sherry cask and still is one of my favourites.
When you set out with Lark, was it challenging trying to get hold of oak that sort of had some of these types of characteristics that you'd seen in the Scotch whiskies?
It wasn't so hard, although we did find it much easier to get some Australian port casks, not so many sherry casks. We got them when we could. And because of that, I guess Lark has really developed over time a fondness for maturing its whiskey in Australian port casks or tawny casks. And I think, like the sherry where you get that lovely toffee note, I think in the port casks we get a shaving of the residual port and then recharring it. The recharring creates a lovely red layer which delivers not so much the caramel toffee but more marzipan and plum pudding notes. But there's a sort of a softness and a richness to it as well. One of the things that John said to me on that phone call was, "So Bill, how big are you going to be?" And I remember saying, "Well, John, I think it's a matter of how small I'm going to be. We've only got a wee little still and we'll only be making so many litres at a time." And he said, "Oh, you'll probably want to play around with those 120-odd litre quarter casks." He said, "My father did that." He said, "I couldn't wait to take over and get rid of the silly things." "Why would you do that?" "Oh," he said, "way too expensive for maturing whiskey. You know, you think about it, you can only put half the amount of whiskey in the barrel and cost twice as much to make the barrel and cut it down from a big one. I said, so why did your father play around with these quarter casks? And he said, oh, he had this funny idea that a whiskey matured in a quarter cask would deliver a richness and intensity of flavour that you perhaps can't get in a bigger barrel. And that'll happen sooner. But the time wasn't the issue for me. It was, I thought, if we're ever going to produce a whiskey that the market will want and seek out, it has to be a big bowl, rich and intensely flavoured whiskey. And so we decided that we would make that a signature of Lark. We would use quarter casks. So in the early days, it was easy to find port. We would find sherry when we wanted them. Of course, that's getting harder and harder and harder as more of our friends start up distilleries. They're out there chasing down the same barrels that we are. I guess we're fortunate in that we have a very, very good relationship with Seppelsfield in the Barossa, and we're able to procure some sensational old Para Port barrels and some of the Seppelsfield sherry casks as well. So we can still get them. And the secret for us, though, is maturing in the quarter casks still.
People in Australia now sort of think of Lark as probably being one of the bigger players in the industry, and I think the company must be putting down a few hundred thousand litres of whiskey every year would be my sense, still under a million. And, you know, in a global sense, in a Scotch whiskey industry sense, that's really quite small still, isn't it?
Oh, look, it really is. You think distilleries like Glenfiddich are putting down somewhere around about 15 million litres a year, you know, and Glenfarclas is up around 10 million litres or something a year. You know, yeah, Lark is still very, very small. I guess, though, there's a lot of craft distilleries around Australia that would look at Lark now and see us as a sort of a big corporate distillery. But I've got to say, I'm very pleased to say that our distillers still make whiskey the way Lynn and I did when we started. We've only got small stills. They work a bit longer than Lynn and I did. And they take great care to ensure that we're making whiskey the way Lynn and I made it when we started. So people often ask, when does a craft distillery not become a craft distillery? When does it get of a size that it's more of a huge commercial operation? And I say, in all honesty, I don't think size matters. I think it's how you make your whiskey that's more important. That's what determines whether you're a craft distillery or not.
Now, you do, of course, obviously have a beautiful new site there in Pontville, formerly known as Sheen Estate. You know, that sort of brings into the business a larger scale distillery though, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, it does. It's a pretty exciting time, actually, for me to, you know, we started off on our kitchen table. I've still got the table out here and there. But to finally find a home as wonderful as the Sheen Estate is just a dream come true. And for a long time, there's been a lot of interest in our whiskies overseas. We started exporting a number of years ago, and then the Australian market and the demand for whiskey in Australia, Lark whiskey, just took off to the point where we had to sort of cut back from exporting. But with moving to a site like Sheen and being able to build a bigger distillery, and we have been producing a lot more whiskey lately, that our next move will be to get back into export. Now, I see that as a great thing, certainly for Lark, but also for the whole of the industry. There's a huge demand out there for Tasmanian whiskey and Australian whiskey. Not many people have been able to satisfy that demand to any great extent. And with distilleries like Lark eventually producing the volumes they'll be doing, you've got Sullivan's Cove, Hillier's Road, new distilleries like Callington Mill, and you've got Archie Rose in Sydney and Starwood, we'll finally be able to get out there and satisfy some of that international demand. And I see that working for everybody in the industry, the small distillers and the big distilleries, the smaller ones that would love to be having their whiskey showcased around the world, will find that there will be an opportunity for them to get out there now, and people will come to Australia, to Tasmania, to visit these bigger distilleries, but they'll seek out the craft distilleries like, you know, James, when people travel, they always like to come back with a tale that they discovered some great little place or some great little venue. That'll be the same when the Tasmanian and Australian brand get out through the world more than it is today.
Now, I was interested to read, I think it was in the annual report last year, but there's a column still at Coal Valley that's producing some new make, which I assume must be grain whiskey. Can you tell us anything about that project?
Yeah, that happened as a result of COVID, of course. And I mean, the very early COVID times, hand sanitizer was in short supply, and Lark decided to meet that challenge and approached a local steelmaker here to put together and design and make a column still. And, you know, it was always known that in time the demand for hand sanitizer would diminish, and the plan was that it would become a still for making neutral spirit to make our gin with. Instead of bringing the neutral spirit in, we would make our own. But what the distillers out there have discovered is that, if, unlike a lot of grain spirits which are made from malted barley and unmalted barley, wheat and other grains, we've only been using malted barley. So the spirit is a malt spirit. I was a bit nervous about it, the fact that it might lose some of that depth of character that you can get in a pot still. But quite surprisingly, the spirit is really very yummy. It's a lot lighter, but that's okay. I think there's plenty of room for expressions of whiskey that are lighter in style. And so the distillery is playing around with producing a grain spirit, but it's a single malt grain spirit. It's going into barrels, and we've just got to wait some years now to see how it turns out.
It wouldn't be called a single malt, though, would it? Because it's not produced in a pot still. Yeah.
No, I use the word single in the sense that it's from one distillery. But
sure.
I use the word malt because a lot of people know that grain spirits are typically produced from quite a number of different grains.
Presumably, with a column still comes production efficiencies and, you know, the ability to possibly bring a product to market. There's just a little bit more price competitive than, you know, some of the other Lark products, which are obviously all firmly in the luxury sort of space.
I think that's the strategy behind it all. Initially, it wasn't the intention. The intention was to produce a neutral spirit to make gin. But, you know, discovering that using a malted barley grain and producing a good spirit, yeah, I think there's an opportunity down the track to be producing a whiskey at that end of the market you just mentioned.
The innovation pipeline at Lark over the last couple of years has been incredibly fast-paced. There's been so many new products coming out, the incredible Seppelsfield casks, the Cannotto cask releases, you know, the Christmas cask. What have been the Wolf of the Willows, another sort of popular one finished in those Imperial Stout casks? What have been some of your favourites from this incredible array of new products?
Yeah, well, I mean, it just depends on the time of year and things too, but I really love the Christmas cask releases and the story behind that, but the spirit itself. We've done a number of releases of Sherry Sherry, which are, that's getting back to that Glenfarclas 15-year-old style, and I'm really loving those releases. And we've had a couple of really lovely delicate rum releases. That's been quite exciting, and certainly working in collaboration with the Wolf in the Willows is also... Yeah, pretty damn good whiskey.
So you're pretty happy with what Chris and the team are cooking up down there?
Yeah, I am. I don't know when they're going to slow down. but look, it's always really good to see what they do. And I know the boys down at the distillery are as passionate as anybody. You know, one of the things that Lynn and I said to ourselves when we started is we were never going to release a whiskey that we weren't truly happy to share with our friends, and with our friends being honest with us to tell us whether they really like it or not. And that's a philosophy that stayed through. And Chris and the boys in the distilling team, and when I say boys, I think Lark now nearly employs more than 50% of our workforce are female, and there's quite a few of those in the brewing and distilling side of it as well. They're a really great team, and they're very conscious of the history of Lark and how it got to be where it is today.
There's been, you know, a few twists and turns along the journey of Lark as a ASX-listed company in recent years. And in 2019, you were, you know, very much opposed to the boardroom coup that sort of led to the current board structure that we have today. Are you sort of happy with how things have evolved and happy with the current management and the direction of where things are going?
Yeah, look, I really am. I guess my opposition or my reaction to the challenge to the board was one of, why do we need to do it so quickly? I just felt it would have been better to perhaps transition over a period of time, and I'd spoken to the other board members and they were all happy with that. But it just was felt by some that they wanted to change and change straight away. And I said, well, that's okay, but look, I'll step back from that a bit. I'm really very happy to simply be your brand ambassador. And I've got to say, I look at, you know, the distillery now, and Lynn and I often talk about this and say, how could you think that we're not happy when Lark's employing 80 wonderful people, and they really are a great team of people. There's a huge demand for our whiskey. People love what the distillery's producing. The company's going from strength to strength. You know, certainly not the company that Lynn and I started, but the philosophies are still there. The dedication to producing the sort of whiskey that we wanted to produce is still there. And what this new company structure's done has been able to bring the right amount of capital along to the business that we could never do, to be able to grow back into the export market and really put Tasmania and Australian whiskey on the international map. I see all of that as positive. And, yeah, look, I've had to sort of accept that it's not the distillery that Lynn and I started, but I look and think it really is a wonderful distillery and employing some fantastic people. I mean, that's always the worry, that a company's focused on its share price and return to investors, and that's important. But I can tell you in all sincerity that the board members and the management team are really focused on looking after the people that work for Lark and the consumer. They really are focused on that, and they believe, like Lynn and I always did, that if we make a good product, the money will follow and people will support our brand.
The company has copped a little bit of stick from, you know, the traditionalists with the evolution into the House of Lark and sort of multiple distilleries under the Lark banner. Do you have a personal feeling one way or the other on that strategy?
Yeah, look, I probably shared some of those concerns myself early on. It certainly wasn't what Lynn and I intended to do, but when you look at the way they've done it and what they're doing, I can put my hand on my heart and say that every single product, I'm proud to say, you know, that we've had an involvement with the company and that it's a good product. And I've been strong at the grassroots level with our association, trying to formulate the rules around how we define what is, to start with, Tasmanian whiskey and Australian whiskey. I'm very strong on truth in labelling. And I know some people have made some comments that they're not always sure which distillery some of these products come from, but we're sort of dealing with that at the moment. Some of those distilleries don't want us to use their name, and so we've had to sort of deal with that. But I think the company's putting the whiskies out in a way that the market has changed and become more sophisticated from what it was when Lynn and I started. I think there's an acceptance that, you know, distilleries will inevitably, as they get bigger, need to be doing similar things. Blending malt whiskies from different distilleries and putting out releases, something that's happened in Scotland over the years anyway. Yeah, I can understand why some people may have had some concerns. I did initially, but I'm very, very happy with what's coming out now.
Yeah, and there seems to be sort of a desire for people to compare the Australian industry to how things are done in Scotland when they're very different, you know, very different industries at very different points of their development, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and I'll say this till I die. I love my Scottish malts and I really regard highly the work that the Scottish industry have done, and I would never want to take anything away from them. But we're not Scotland. We're Australia. And Australians are known to be innovative and adventurous, and I don't know that we have to conform to those traditions that come from Scotland. I will always love and respect those whiskies that I still do. I've got shelves full of them all around my office. But I think it's wonderful to see what Australia's doing and what some of the craft distilleries are doing, you know, experimenting with different barrel types and a whole host of things. And I see what Lark is doing is just sort of moving into the modern era that the Australian whiskey scene is. You know, along the way, I think our industry will develop, I guess, its own tradition and rules around what it can do. But at the moment, I think it's pretty exciting that we've got an opportunity to come to the world with different Australian whiskies done the Australian way.
There was a bit of talk a while ago about it, and I think you just touched on this before, a Tasmanian whiskey appellation of sorts. Is that kind of gone quiet or is that still being talked about?
Oh, no, it's still being talked about very much, and it's, I think we're, you know, very close to being in agreement with how that should work. But we're now just going through all the bureaucratic red tape involved in achieving that appellation. It takes a lot longer than I'd like. I'd like us to think that we might have achieved that by now, but we're looking at geographic indicators, you know, much along the lines of the French defining what is a cognac, and hopefully it won't be too long before in Australia we'll be defining what is an Australian whiskey. But it'll encompass all of those wonderful innovative things that we're starting to see happen around Australia.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for joining us for a chat, and congratulations on the anniversary, and look forward to hopefully toasting it with you over a fine dram sometime soon.
That'll be good, James. Look forward to it. Good on you.
And you can get your hands on a variety of Lark's exciting limited release whiskies now at larkdistillery.com. There's whiskies like Lark Origins, a special single malt crafted with water from Lake Sorel, where Bill Lark had that fateful discussion with his father-in-law that led to him founding Lark Distillery. This special release celebrating 30 years of Tasmanian whiskey is available now at larkdistillery.com. The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at by James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.